So today, we are opening a couple of Rieslings. It's a nice warm afternoon here, so... So we have one from Alsace and one from the Mosel.
So Riesling, what do you like about Riesling?
I like that it's a little tart, high acidity. Oh. Makes me want to drink more of it. I think that's what I would say. So this one from the Mosel, it's got pretty good color on it.
The first one that we're tasting is Mosel Riesling, a dry Spätlese from 2012 from Sibylle Kunz. I bought this actually at the winery last July when I was taking like a group of people on a trip there from the Mickelberger. We all went.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah. And we actually visited these wines, and I hadn't actually tasted her wines before this visit. And her husband, Marcus, like, welcomed us in, took us through all of the wines, and then we actually started buying wines directly for the hotel.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. But they've got quite a good reputation in the UK. Really simple labels, just like
beautiful.
The squares, yeah.
Has a kind of a Pantone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
feel
it does.
It
really reminds, yeah, you're right. Yeah. Also because each of the different ones have different colours.
Oh,
so
really?
It feels even more.
Yeah, more Pantone-y. Actually, this colour's quite nice. It's like a mustardy, chartreusey. Like you think
semi-gold.
Yeah. Could be like a color of a wool coat or something. I don't know. So on the nose, what do you get?
I really like this wine because it's got all these sort of sweet elements on the nose. So
yeah,
these
totally.
Lovely fruitiness, this floral, like, it's really typical Mosel for me. This lovely, like, blossom. It's like apple, pear fruit, honey.
Honey, yeah.
So for some people, obviously, they first smell it and they think, oh, it's going to be sweet because of all of these flavours. But this lovely purity, like it could be no other grape variety. I just think it sings. This is, for me, what is so special about Riesling is the fact that when you taste Riesling, you know it's Riesling. It's unmistakable. That's what makes this grape interesting. And actually, the second part of that being, which hopefully we'll see in these two wines, which I'm sure we will, is the fact that even though you see the grape variety, you see where the grape variety is grown.
Right.
It's one of the best
distinctive.
Grapes for that. Yeah, one of the best grapes to be able to realise where it's coming from. So good.
Mm.
So, I mean, in terms of Mosel, this isn't super light. It's 13% alcohol. Yeah, which is, I mean, it's still light in the world of wines. It's light in body. It's very, very pure, very, very clean. This lovely slaty mineral clean finish comes through at the end. But I think, you know, what we all historically used to think of when we thought of Mosel white wines, we were thinking of these off-dry, low alcohol.
Right. I think that's what I was taught that it would be, low alcohol, lighter.
Bit of sugar.
More delicate, yeah.
Yeah. Which also is really nice because the natural acidity level is so high. Because it's a cooler region and they leave the grapes on the vine for ages.
Right.
We have these warm days, the reflection from the river, which obviously helps the grapes ripen and build up sugar in the daytime, and the cool evenings allow
the
acid levels
to stay.
I guess the new sort of trend, or the more, what we're seeing more of from the Mosel, are these fully dry styles of wine, obviously with a slightly higher alcohol level.
Yes, that's just what people are drinking more these days than the...
Yeah, I think so. I know that like, one of our best sellers, like the Mickelberger, for example, is like it's a different producer coming from Saar, Peter Lauer Riesling. Like,
oh, yeah.
We...
Super
like,
young, we buy that at home lots,
It's like the mascot wine for Mickelberger. All of the staff are like, Peter Lauer.
Yeah.
Because it just sells so well.
It's so easy to drink and, really delicious.
Yeah.
But I think also this is... It's the thing, you know, having grown up in North America, when I think of German wines, especially wines in, you know, the distinctive bottle that Riesling comes in, you know, we only ever really got super sweet wines from Germany at restaurants in North America. So you end up with this, like, idea that everything's going to taste like Blue Nun.
But that would have been in the 80s, wouldn't it?
Well, really.
When you were young. you were like a child where you would have witnessed people
drinking.
Would have
been the 90s and stuff. Yeah, 80s and 90s.
Yeah, but like during the 80s and 90s, the quality of wine and the wines that we were sort of that were being distributed from Germany were terrible, most of them. And most of them were like Black Tower or Blue Nun. You know, they were the better examples. Hock, obviously, in England, I used to always see that as a kid, like, oh, there's those big bottles of Hock over there.
And then Blue Nun, you know, because it was blue glass, and you don't see that so often.
And Black Tower, like, also in that weird shape.
Oh, yeah, it looked like a Unilever bottle or something. But it's funny because I feel like Germany is still recovering from that idea. That moment in time has everyone's consciousness thinks of, like, German wines are sweet, syrupy. And, I mean, they do have a lot of nice sweet wines here, but not the only...
I think you're right, though. They are, and this is what's actually quite interesting. This would be an interesting topic to cover another day, would be like wine scandals and how they affect a region's reputation. And how long that takes for the recovery from that. And I think German wine still, for many people, I mean, most people can't even pronounce Riesling. You'd be surprised how many people say, oh, I'll have a bottle of Riesling. It's like dyslexia everywhere. Yeah.
So strange.
E is before the S.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think, you know, that's not the biggest deal, but is there one really great cheap Riesling brand that you find that's going to get people interested in the grape? I don't know. And it's not...
I think maybe. There probably are. Yeah. I just think that they just don't get exported outside of Germany.
Yeah. I think Germany is the only place to get, like, good value, cheap.
Yeah, yeah. Because I feel like I've definitely bought some nice ones since moving to Germany. But that's been the nice thing about moving here, is experiencing German wines in a way that I'd never... had before.
I mean, this was the other thing that was quite difficult for German wine. Obviously, there was like a big wine scandal in 85.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, several Austrian wineries illegally adulterated their wines using this toxic substance, which is the main ingredient for most brands of antifreeze.
Oh my God.
Yeah. To make the wines appear like they were sweeter and more full-bodied in the later harvest-style wines. And many of these Austrian wines were exported to Germany, and some of them were sent in bulk and bottled in large-scale wineries and often blended with German wines. So this was a huge, huge, huge scandal that I think for ages. Wow. Yeah, like, I mean, it's not that long ago, is it?
Yeah, then 25 years ago. And people's distrust then of certain things, it stays, it gets passed on from a generation to the next. Because people, you know, they really do remember what their parents... drank or what they didn't, and that's how you get introduced to things.
And I think this is quite interesting because it talks about that after that scandal, a lot of producers started just to move towards dry wines. Mm-hmm. I think probably because they were easier to sell, and maybe that's also why things started in Germany that way as well.
But do you think that has anything to do with, I mean, you think like these kind of scandals, people altering things, you know, the German rules about sugar, residual sugar, and what you can name things and what has to have exactly what in it. I think things in Germany and Austria seem a bit more precise in terms of what's allowed and what's not, no?
Yeah, I would say it's interesting because it's kind of, particularly like German Riesling, it's like cool and uncool.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, which I actually find a lot of things in Germany like that, as in through my experience. There are so many things that are cool and uncool at the same time.
Socks and Birkenstocks.
Yeah, cool and kitsch. Yeah, like it happens a lot, but... And just Birkenstocks.
I mean, I don't own a pair yet. I feel like it's next on my to-do list. I'll like really be a resident of Germany once I get those Birkenstocks on my feet.
Yeah, then you fully integrated. Become, they're part of the continent then.
Yeah.
But
you're saying cool and uncool.
Yeah, and I think I was thinking about this earlier on today when I was having a shower, as one does. But I was thinking about German wine and how I see it and how I understand the outside world to see it and understand it. And it's really exciting in many ways. And actually, in terms of like farming respectfully, like Germany was one of the first countries to really take that seriously.
I mean, they're good with food, with everything here is really top-notch, you know?
A friend of mine, she works in the movies, she does lighting, and she's a vegan. So she often doesn't always have time to shop for food. So she gets like these vegan packs sent to her, like where they give you different ingredients all the time. And she told me like... most of the stuff and most of the good stuff is German, the vegan products that she uses. And I just think in terms of their sort of like, let's say, carbon footprint being a little bit more green, I would definitely say Germany being one of the like front runners for that in Europe. So most of the producers actually have been farming at least organically, if not biodynamically, for decades.
Yeah.
Like Sibylla Kuntz, I think, was one of the first. And that, I think, I'd have to double check, but I think that was in the 80s she started doing
that.
But
that's kind of like Austrian wine too, you know, and then people don't see them as being these, you know, they don't end up in the same category as the cool, hip, natural wines, because they're made like classic wines. They don't taste funky or weird. They're just super well made with low intervention.
Yeah, and I mean, there is a use of sulfur, which you see probably more heavily maybe in Austrian and German wines in general, or sure. At least the top wines that are well received, if you like. But that is also starting to change. I mean, the movement in like Burgenland in Austria.
Right.
It's ridiculous now. There's so many natural wine producers, or let's say people that definitely farm organically that are using less additives. And I think that is the same in Germany. We just always assume that Mosel Riesling and German Mosel Riesling is really heavily sulfured. Some of it is because it's made to last, but a lot of it isn't. And a lot of it is coming from organically grown grapes, which makes it interesting.
But, yeah, totally.
Well, at least interesting for me. I think she is... Doesn't say on the back. I thought she was Demeter certified. But her story was quite interesting because her parents had the winery before. And I think it was supposed to be her brother that was supposed to take it over, and he didn't show an interest. And she started... Really? Yeah, Barker's saying like she started with like a wine shop and her own small vineyards, and then slowly built up the vineyard holdings. And now is regarded as one of the better producers. One of the first producers, I don't know if they were the first, because I've know a few examples now, but one of the first to experiment with skin contact Riesling as well in the Mosel, which is not so common.
Yeah, I was going to say, not too much about that.
It's just called organic Riesling.
Really?
It's got an orange square on it.
Nice and simple, straightforward.
Yeah. What do you think about this wine?
I think it's really nice. I think it's definitely packs more of a punch than I expected it to.
Yeah.
It's definitely like you feel the alcohol on it a little bit.
Yeah, I think for me as well, it's like full flavoured.
Yeah, it's really like...
Yeah.
I could definitely drink a lot more of that. And it's still really grapey, has that sort of...
I think it's just that like lovely... I know what you mean. It's got this lovely fruitiness to it. It's just like
real fruit, not just the imagined fruit. Like it really just tastes yummy.
Just makes you hungry.
Yeah, totally.
When you haven't had lunch.
We haven't. Well, I had some peanut butter and jam toast.
Interestingly as well about this, so I think I always, when I was learning a bit about the Pradicat system.
Which is very complicated to learn about for me.
I think it is and I think it isn't. A lot of it at first, when you're learning about wine, you're already quite familiar with a lot of the French terms.
Sure.
So there isn't a language barrier, but for a lot of people with German wine, they're like... How do I say all those
these
words?
Like Pretty Katzenweine and like Spätlese or all these sort of Auslese.
And I actually think it's like the lingo, if you like, that scares people off more than anything. But if we break it down really simply, Cabernet, Spätlese, Auslese, we'll just look at those for now.
Yeah.
What we're really talking about is there has to be a minimum must weight, which means there has to be a minimum amount of sugar content, so a minimum amount of ripeness.
Right.
So technically, you can make dry styles of all of those wines. So you can have a dry Auslese, but in general, they tend to go up in sweetness because they're riper, there is more potential sweetness.
And then,
and with this acidity level, it's more likely that you're balancing the sugar with the acid, so they would be. But in this example, we're on Spätlese, which is trocken, so this is fully fermented, all the sugars are fermented, which is why we have that higher alcohol, because it's late to harvest.
Right.
Which we have a similar
system. Which is what Spätlese is. Late harvest in Auslese is?
It's just like after harvest.
Yeah, after harvest. Even later.
Yeah, even later.
Even later.
So I always, because I always, when I first learned about it, I was like, but a Spätlese, it's going to be sweet. And someone's like, no, it's not. Just like, we're talking about sugar, potential sweetness, potential alcohol, and where that winemaker decides to ferment it out till.
I do have to say that a lot of my friends, they don't always trust what it says on the bottle when it comes to German wine. Because it'll say trocken, but it's not always that trocken. You know what I mean? Sometimes they just leave that smidge. I don't know whether it's just a style thing. I feel like there are rules for everything here, so that's obviously there are lots of rules that they probably have to follow. But I do feel like every now and again you get a truck and that feels like there's still a little something in there.
Which there could be. Like, I mean, there could be with a lot of wines that we try that say that they're dry.
Yeah.
In any, you know, like even in French wine.
Sure. Yeah, I think maybe that's the thing, though, because not on every bottle of French wine will it say dry, half dry. You know, that they don't always bother. Okay. And I think that's what it is. Because it says dry, then there's an expectation. If you open a bottle of French wine and you don't know what's going on with it, you just take it as it is. You're not like, damn it, you told me it was going to be dry.
What I have for Trocken German wines, it's like it says for like low acid wines up to 4 grams per litre.
Okay.
Medium acid wines, but up to high acid wines, up to 9 grams per litre. So they can almost be off dry. Then Harbtroppen, it goes up to sort of between 12 and 18 grams. So we're looking, you know, like that is, these can be slightly off dry, I guess. It's a really loose.
So that's where it gets a bit tricky because you,
Then you've got fine herb, which is unregulated, but usually slightly sweeter than Harbtroppen. And then it goes up to like Lieblich, Rest Süß. Or like Zeus or
sweeter and Zeus. Crazy sweet.
Mm. So, you know, that is also the case. But I guess, you know, I really hope it comes to a day when, which I think it does, at least in the wine trade, we all look for balance rather than just like, let's drink the driest wine.
Because, totally. Yeah. I mean, I like things that are a little...
Yeah.
I mean, there are also foods that you need wine that has a little sweetness to it. Like the last time I had a... Riesling Spätlese with food. I think we made it with Flammkuchen with lots of nice cheese on it. But
like
caramelized
onion. Like the pizza, like the savory Flammkuchen. Yeah. Okay.
With it was like caramelized onion, and we had some dates on there and some cheese. Super yummy with this kind of thing.
Oh, that would be really nice. Always like washed Rhine cheese, like, you know, like Pont l'Evêque or something like that. That would be quite nice. Or even Taleggio.
Yeah.
Quite nice with Riesling. Especially if it's got a few grams of residual sugar, it's really nice.
Yeah.
Stinky, you know, like a little bit of stinky, funky cheese.
But I think there is always a little mustiness also with Riesling.
With age, but this is 2012, so it's got 6 years of age, so it is developing. But I actually think it's really impressive for a wine with such age that it's still so much fruit.
Yeah, it's still big and fresh.
So with this particular Spätlese, when we talk about the sweetness level... This actually has residual sugar of 8.2 grams. It's just on the edge being able to be called Trocken.
But it's funny because it doesn't feel super sweet, though. I would say this one doesn't feel necessarily like...
So the total acidity is 7.3 grams, which obviously for most people that doesn't necessarily mean anything. It's just numbers, but that's quite high. So it's just balancing it out, isn't it?
Sweet and sour.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Probably good with sweet and sour pork too.
This would be great. Yeah, it'd be really nice with something spicy, like or Thai food.
Chinese food or
barbecue Thai food.
Mm. Yeah, yum. I'm really curious about the other one now.
This is the other thing. I looked anyway because of its slate soils. We've got quite low pH in the soil. It's like 3, which is relatively low.
Mm-hmm.
Which we won't get into the science behind this, but often I find the wines that have this perception of freshness generally seem to have a lower pH from the soils. So that would also help balance that, at least perceived, like it would help it at least seem even fresher than it is.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of botrytis, there's 5 to 10% botrytis in this wine.
I feel like you can see that a little bit.
Yeah, that slightly raisined, that honeyed note as well that you see. It's nice. And it just says that 2012 was like a really good vintage for them for exceptional fragrance.
Which I would agree. Delicious.
Really nice.
So I'm very curious about the second one.
Because
I was told, I haven't had it before, I was told that it presented not like a Riesling.
Okay.
So... I'm curious.
I'm curious too. It's 2014
Heisenberg Riesling from Domaine
Ostertag.
Yeah.
I love the Ostertag wines.
I have never tried any.
So Ostertag as well, completely biodynamic. I followed these wines for quite some time actually. And I really like them, and this is someone who's actually very outspoken about his use of sulfur. Not that I want to talk too much about sulfur because it's an incredibly dull topic, but
that everyone loves to
but for those people who are interested, he is someone that actively says, like, you know, I make wines that are going to travel the world. I want to know that when my customers receive them, they're going to be in good condition, so I add sulfur. But everything else he does is quite measured and quite obviously quite thoughtful, and his farming is completely biodynamic, so that also means that
The quality of the fruit is very high because he's really working well in the vineyards, which I think for me is always something I care about. Like, I was reading about, like, a friend of mine was interviewed recently on integrity and integrity in wine, and how we try not to be swayed sometimes by our own personal feelings towards people. But, you know, she was sort of saying, how can you buy a wine from somebody you don't agree with, like, when they treat people really terribly or whatever? And how can you buy wine when you know, like, they're really doing something quite damaging to the planet? Right. And we don't want to get too deep and philosophical, but it's really nice sometimes when you taste a wine that does taste absolutely amazing, it's alive, and you know that people are working in a really respectful way.
I mean, I think that's sort of the nice thing about the push right now about natural wine. You know, not all natural wine is good, but it's good that people are paying attention to maybe how people are producing things, that it's not always just about the end result, that there is a process to it.
Yeah, and that it's agricultural.
Exactly. It is an agricultural product, and you have to take care of the land that it's on.
Like any agricultural product, like, I mean, we all know those, like, tomatoes that come from Holland that are grown in wind tunnels that are orange in color and they're not red. I have no flavour.
And then you eat one from Naples and you're like, my God.
From Nonna's garden, which is just like, I just chuck some seeds down and the sun grew them.
Yeah.
And nothing else happened. You know, I think we all, you know, we all can appreciate something that's made well.
Sure, exactly.
Are you going to finish your glass or do you need a... I'll finish my water glass, you can tip it into it.
I did have quite a bit of wine last night, so...
Riesling is the perfect hangover drink to wake up.
I was going to say, it is kind of a brunchy wine.
Yeah, this we could be ordering some scrambled eggs right now.
Yeah, totally, I could see that. I like things with this...
Charcuterie.
Frühstück, German Frühstück, perfect. But I definitely like wines like this with a little tiny bit of sugar left in them for brunch. I think it's always like...
I mean...
Good breakfast wine.
I saw what you were drinking the other night as well.
That's my brunch one. Yeah.
Yeah, which is off dry. Every time I think of off dry, I mean, you love Gewürztraminer. So every time I think of off dry wines, I think of you.
I don't know. I just think there's lots of places for them. And I think brunch is one of them. Like, Le Bulle is, une bulle, I think it is. Yeah, it's perfect, like, breakfast bubbles. It's not super bubbly. A little bit sweet.
Okay, so we're pouring the 2014 Riesling Heisenberg from Domaine Ostertag, 100% Riesling, coming from Alsace in France. So not miles away, actually, from the Mosel, in terms of geography. Just over the French border.
And I mean, Alsace has changed hands so many times over the course of centuries that, I mean, it was Germany at one point, so... Maybe not the Frenchest of the regions.
If you want a second glass to compare, I can get you one.
Definitely a little lighter on the...
Yeah, it's not so aromatic, actually.
No, maybe a little more minerally.
Heisenberg. So Heisenberg, I'm assuming, is the vineyard. So that it's a 25 years old, pink sandstone, gneiss, and granite. And it's got some more vineyard in total.
Gneiss is also a type of
soil.
Yeah. Also stony.
Gneiss is a mixture. You see it quite a lot in, also see it in the Loire Valley. It's like a metamorphic rock.
Yeah, I think when I looked it up, it is something sort of. But it's funny that you said that it's the same in the Loire Valley because.
You see like a few muscadets that are called gneiss.
Yeah.
So it's a metamorphic soil.
Mm-hmm.
Metamorphic soils have been transformed from another type of rock through heat and pressure over millions of years. Gneiss is a fairly infertile soil formed of either volcanic, granite, or schist soil.
So it's kind of a mix of...
Minerals are arranged in bands, like a little sandwich.
Like a layer cake.
Or a cake, that run through the rock. It's very hard, very infertile. So it's really good for grapes.
So perfect for grapes, yeah.
Yeah, and really famous in Austrian wine as well, so really famous in Wachau and Cantal.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And you said also in the Loire, similar ground in some
ways? Yeah, I've seen a few muscadets that are on gneiss.
On gneiss.
Yeah. And so interesting here, we've had like two metamorphic sources, slate, obviously in the mm-hmm. Mosel before, which is Mosel's most famous Riesling area for slate, I guess. But so this is a mixture of gneiss and sandstone.
Pink sandstone. I should have my dad on here one time talking about rocks.
Yeah, we should.
just a geology lesson.
Yeah, we should.
Could be fun.
Yeah.
Well, there is a Master Somme that has a degree in geology, I think.
So this is interesting. So it says that it's a small vineyard, Heisenberg, translating, which obviously is a German word, as we talked about before, mm-hmm. close to Germany, translates as hot mountain in... so we've talked a bit about the soils, but it's predominantly south-facing. So it says typically fleshy mineral wines with generous exotic aromas. I don't find this hugely exotic on the nose yet, but I reckon it's a bit closed.
But it could also be after the one we've just had.
And I reckon it needs a bit of time in the glass. Yeah. I would decant it.
Yeah, I think that's what she might have told me to do, actually.
Really?
She might have said to decant it.
Well, we're here now.
We're here.
It's also in the cool glass. To try it straight from the bottle, I think.
Yeah. It's definitely lighter. Oh, careful.
Yeah, better.
Mm-hmm.
Your wine will not open up and you're not worried about getting messy, just put your hand on top of the glass and shake it. You might get wet, but the wine will smell more. Yeah. Slightly less pronounced on the nose, but I think that's also because Mosel Riesling is so... When you go back to the Mosel Riesling now, you really get that slaty...
Yeah, totally.
The perfume is there, the blossom is there, but then it's like pure slate, whereas now when you smell this, it definitely you get more like fruit, ripe fruit. It is more exotic, like almost like pineapple.
Yeah, it's also some like flowers, like white flowers.
And almost like chamomile.
Yeah, but it still has a little bit of this...
Baked apple thing going on. It's almost like a...
There's also that same little musty kind of petrol-y thing a little bit too.
See, I don't find either of them musty. I think the one before was starting to show some more developed sign, but I think your petrol-y, this waxy...
I think it's the petrol-y kind of thing that I'm maybe...
And with this one, do you know what it reminds me of? Like, Tupperware. Have you ever left, like, Tupperware in the sun and you open up that smell of, like, warm Tupperware?
Yeah.
I don't know why I know that... I'm sniffing it all the time.
You know, there's going to be a moment where no one even knows what Tupperware smells like because people only have that disposable stuff from the supermarket.
That's true. But you know, like the cheap Tupperware like they used to be where they were like slightly flexible? Now you get these like really rigid plastic boxes which don't smell so much.
I just remember the actual Tupperware with the like sun pattern top with the... And most of them had spaghetti in them, so they always had that sort of like weird bolognese smell to them, which is not what this smells like.
Thank God.
I feel bad you guys have to listen to us, like, gurgle.
It's the best part. Sounds of the mouth.
Ugh.
It's nice. It's a richer, more opulent style, but I still think it's very true to the grape variety. I think it's aromatic compared to other wines. It's less, like, floral than the wine before.
Mm-hmm.
More exotic, more body, more viscous, more textured. But it's still like a nice thing.
It seems pretty delicate, a little more delicate than the other one. For me, anyway, I'm feeling like it's...
I think it's more closed on the nose, but I find the wine before more subtle.
But maybe it's discreet. Because there's so much perfume, it sort of makes it feel like bigger. Yeah.
There's more, I think the wine before may be more intense in terms of aromatics, but more they're more delicate and like different. It's a different detail. Yeah, whereas this is... There is more body here. It's deeper, richer. I know what you said, that the woman that sold it to you said like it reminds her of Chenin. Mm-hmm. And I can see what she means because there's like a slight nuttiness there as well. So that kind of makes sense. This like little bit of nuttiness on it.
Would that be a typical Chenin thing, the nut?
Well, I don't know. I just don't think you'd think of like nuttiness with Riesling. I don't know if this has been...
I don't know whether... Because I don't feel like I would... You think this would definitely be... You would pick a Riesling if you tasted it blind.
I mean, you could never say 100%.
But it's presenting like a Riesling.
I think it's more of a Riesling than anything else, but I can understand like if somebody thought off dry Chenin or something like that, maybe it would be the other alternative. It would be one of the two.
In Alsace, generally, is it warmer, colder than the Mosel?
A lot warmer, and very dry there as well.
Okay.
So
so you do end up usually with
body, drier styles in general, but not... It's a bit of a confusing region, Alsace. I'm yet to travel there, and I'd really like to go because there's lots of sort of different towns, but all of the different producers have their different styles. So there are some people that make off-dry styles. There are people that make dry styles. Some are a bit lighter, some are a bit richer. But in general, I guess we always assume a little bit more body, drier, okay. more alcohol.
Are there other
less,
parts?
I always think of them less aromatic, more waxy.
Okay, more waxy, okay.
Yeah, then like Mosel, just think of like spring garden.
Right. Most. Yeah, lush.
English garden, yeah.
Yeah, totally. Oh,
and
I can
really
see that.
Really delicate, light, pure, yeah. pristine.
Are there other regions in Germany, perhaps, that would show the same way?
Fouts, maybe?
A little warmer
or
also.
Or flatter, yeah, it's yeah. flatter and warmer.
It's funny because I also don't necessarily drink so many wines from Alsace.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's still, like, something we haven't touched on, like, in terms of, like, value for money, like, when you're looking on a wine list, particularly, like, Mosel Riesling, of course, there are some really iconic wines, like Keller G-Max, which is just, right. like, well, you know, my life will be a success when I can finally afford a bottle for myself. but definitely think these two regions that we're looking at, in terms of, like, the world of wine and... I would say these both fall into like high quality producers.
Right.
You know.
Do you remember
almost the fine wine category?
Do you remember what you paid for?
No.
I can't remember what I even paid.
But they're not cheap. But these aren't cheap.
No, they're not cheap, but they're not crazy.
No, they maybe be under £100 on the wine list, but yeah. it's definitely over £60, £70, £80.
Yeah. I think maybe I paid over 20, around
not
20.
Not retail.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's different. I mean, both of these wines would be sitting at maybe a similar price point of somewhere between £80 to £100 or euros. And I think they're not super cheap, but like
really delicious. Like you would
you know
not
what?
Be unhappy
like,
if you got one of these.
This quality of wine, this level of complexity, yeah. this balance from other regions, you would probably pay more money.
A lot more, yeah.
And we're talking about names. Like Ostertag probably is one of the leading producers, I would say. More famous, like there are some underground, like, interesting guys as well.
I definitely want to try some of his other fancier ones. I was looking at some of the Premier Cru ones that he had. Grand Cru, sorry.
Yeah, like Munchberg, I've yeah. tried a few times before. It's really nice. And that's crazy, that wine. Like, when you taste it, it's like fire. Like, it's so opulent and exotic, and there's so much going on. It's really interesting.
Maybe that'll be my next treat.
Maybe it will. But I've always listed... the cheaper wines from Ostertag, not the Riesling, actually. The Pinot Blanc or Pinot Gris that he makes, they're entry-level because they're...
I feel like there was good value, like the price-wise, it was, yeah. did seem...
And they're good wines to get people on, you know, like the person that usually would drink, like...
Sauvignon.
Yeah, maybe not even Sauvignon, but like someone that would drink, like, Pinot Grigio, but like wants something with a bit more body. Or someone that drinks like Grauburgunder from Germany yeah. or Silvana and they don't want to spend too much money, like you can get them onto like a very yeah. good like or an or like a well made Pinot Blanc, Pinot
but like
Gris
this
from
one,
someone like Ostertag.
Like the one from the Mosel, I feel like if you're a Sauvignon fan from New Zealand and you love big fruit, you wouldn't be unhappy if you got that. I think you'd be like, wow, this is pretty yummy.
Nice. Yeah, I think maybe it might be a little bit light for them, that's the only thing. Because with Sauvignon from New Zealand, we're talking about 13.5% and
sure,
it's
sure.
got higher alcohol.
But how much was this one?
13, but it doesn't feel it.
No, but I think if you were trying something new, it would be in the same, like, if you liked big flavors and, you know, aromatic, something super, that when you put your nose to it, you're like, oh yeah, I want to drink that.
I personally think it'd be too sweet for a lot of people, but I love it. It's so good. Both the wines are very
Both
nice,
are really
very different. Really different. Sibylle Kunz, ready to go. Ooh, ready to go. Ready to go as soon as you open it, I think.
Yeah.
This I would definitely... The
decant it and give it some.
Decanted it, I think. Because you're getting... Every time I go back,
yeah,
I'm getting a little bit more.
A little different. Also, it's not that cold. It is quite warm outside.
But I think that's okay for that.
Yeah, because you get
wine,
more...
Because we're actually smelling more, yeah.
So other notable Rieslings that people should try... Are there any? Is there anything off the top of your head?
I mean, Mosel go-to, like, some of the best value fine wines of the world. Mosel Riesling. I think, you know, the prices are more expensive than they were a few years ago, but they're still ridiculously good value.
Yeah.
Ridiculously good value. To be able to offer, like, a glass of Riesling from a really good producer, even if it's just their entry level for €6 a glass or £6.50 a glass or whatever it is, is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, compared to what you get from France
yeah.
or from other countries, it's really good. The other Rieslings that I've tried recently, obviously, like, immediately the other place you think of is Australia for mm-hmm. Riesling. So, like, South Australia, like, Clare Valley, very nice.
Maybe that's the region, to, yeah, right.
Yeah, or Eden Valley. Mm-hmm. There's some interesting stuff from South Australia. I've been tasting quite a bit from, like, New York State.
Yeah, I really wanted to buy something. Yeah, it was actually on my list. I've been trying to find, so it's hard to find here.
Passing Van. Oh, from Forge Cellars, a French winemaker makes it.
It must be somewhere not on the shelf, maybe.
Yeah,
but they I have was some... looking for it.
Mm. Finger Lakes is another place that's really interesting. Like, I was just, when I was over in Miami, I got to try quite a few wines from Finger mm-hmm. Lakes, obviously, because it's probably one of the most local regions to right. Miami.
Totally, it's like, what, like a 3-hour plane ride? It's not that far.
Yeah, it's not too far. So I tried, and very, actually, you know, and off there are a few people, because of, obviously... Most, when you follow back, like, the new world regions of Riesling, most of the time, it's come from German people taking their vines over.
Yeah, right.
Fleeing prosecution.
Yeah, totally.
Setting up camp somewhere else. I mean, that's definitely what happened in South yeah. Australia. And I think it's the same. There's a lot of German names in Finger Lakes.
Yeah, totally.
And the styles, they make off-dry styles as well. So yeah. it's like actually the closest thing outside of Europe.
But I think that region anyway, historically, there was a lot of Dutch, there was a lot of German, there was a lot of, you know, you see Pennsylvania Dutch, like, yeah. you know, New York City was originally Dutch, and then you ended up with a lot of people from that area of Europe moving at the same time. But I wonder, Canada Austria? Must make some...
Oh, yeah.
Canada must make some Rieslings. I feel like they, in some areas... In Ontario, they must have the weather for
it. My knowledge of Canadian wine is terrible. I've been talking to a friend of mine who works in Canada quite a lot, and I keep saying to him, you should do a wine book on Canadian wine, because there isn't one.
There is, yeah, totally. And there are actually some from Ontario. I mean, most of the nice stuff is from Vancouver, but there are some small producers in Ontario. But I think for a long time, Canada was off the map because it was making... They didn't always have vinifers. Vinifer. It always makes me feel like I'm about
Vitis vinifera.
Yeah, it always makes me feel like I sound like I'm about to sneeze. Yeah, because they have the other type of grape, which I think for...
Yeah, American
Rieslings. Yeah.
Maybe that was it, but I think also it's just that Canadian wines have been so expensive.
Yeah,
and they
you
still
can,
are so expensive.
Yeah, totally.
Other places, obviously Austria. I've yeah. talked about it before, but like, I think Austria is maybe a really great introduction to Riesling before German wine.
For some people, slightly warmer climate too, or?
No, they're just a little bit more savory, more okay. herbal, slightly less of this like hugely blossom aromatic right. thing. So the nose doesn't immediately scare people off.
Yeah.
And in general, really dry styles. So I yeah. think I would definitely, if I was going to give someone Riesling for the first time, I wanted to get them into it, I would like lure them in with some Austrian Riesling. Yeah.
I mean, I like Austrian wine all around.
And I have to say, I've tried one amazing Riesling, but this is not typical from Spain because I'm very skeptical of like,
oh.
it's kind of how I feel about Italians making Pinot Noir, that they should just not do it. But it sounds so judgmental. This is the very qualified winemaker. In the Spanish Pyrenees, there's this little town really? Called Sort, just like yeah. S-O-R-T, Sort. And there's a winery there called Batliu de Sort. They have vineyards on slate.
Mm-hmm.
And just Riesling vines are just planted on there. And because it's in the mountains, it's high altitude, slate soils.
Yeah.
It's relatively cool. Like, they managed to make right. an amazing Riesling.
Wow,
when you try it, you immediately taste it. And you're like, wow, this Riesling. It's like slaty, it's slightly waxy.
Wow, funny.
Citrusy. Like, it's less, a lot less aromatic than right. like the Mosel Rieslings, but more like... I don't know, somewhere in between, like, Alsace and Australia in style, I guess.
Oh, super interesting.
But they've done a really good job, but I think maybe they're one of the few people that have got that really...
They know how to, yeah.
And they're, like, one of the only wineries in the area, and...
Oh, super interesting.
Yeah, that was a very interesting...
I guess it's, like, if you have the right position for the vines and it the sort of perfect storm, then it would work, but maybe not anywhere else. Cool. Anything you want to end with? Any little wrap up on Riesling?
No, I mean, I'll just have another glass of Riesling.
All right, sounds
drink
good.
It.
Fuck lunch. All right. Cool. Well, thanks for listening, and
see you next time.